board members are present and accounted for. I would like to point out that an executive session was held last Thursday evening, March 19th, to discuss legal and personnel matters related to the governor's declaration. And an executive session will follow this meeting to discuss legal and personnel matters. We now need to approve our agenda for this morning. So I'll entertain a motion to approve the agenda.
I'll move to approve the agenda as presented.
I'll second.
We have a motion and a second. Any questions or comments about the agenda?
I'm sorry, who seconded that motion?
Sue.
Okay.
I think it'll be a little hard to do a voice vote in this environment. So if you wouldn't mind, we'll have the secretary call the roll for purposes of approval of the agenda.
Mr. Bensel?
Yes.
Mr. Hartman?
Yes.
Mrs. Heaston?
Yes.
Mrs. Hostler?
Yes.
Mr. Lytle?
Yes.
Mr. Pantano?
Yes.
Mrs. Trout?
Yes.
Mr. Wingard?
Yes.
And Mr. Blevins?
Yes. Our agenda is approved. Thank you. Now we'll move to the first of two opportunities for comments from the public. If there is any member of the public that on the session that would like to make a comment, please state your name and address and make your brief comment. Okay, hearing none. We'll move to the one action item that we have on our agenda today, and that is a resolution that will enable us to suspend our current requirements and for presence at board meetings and to allow a virtual board meeting. And to that end, if someone would read the motion that is shown there and in the form of a motion, make a motion, we'll take a second and then proceed from there. So Mr. Hartman, would you like to do that?
Yes, I'd be happy to. The motion to suspend all policies of the board and administration regulations to the following extent. A, those policies that would prevent the use of a virtual platform to conduct public meetings of the board. B, those policies to the extent that they are inconsistent with what is now required by law. C, those policies that may interfere with the health and safety of students or employees. Or D, those policies that would unnecessarily impede compliance with what is required by law.
Okay. I'll second that.
There's a motion by Mr. Hartman and a second by Mr. Bensel. Any questions or comments about the action item? Okay. Hearing none, call the roll, please.
Mr. Bensel?
Yes.
Mr. Hartman?
Yes.
Mrs. Heaston?
Yes.
Mrs. Hostler?
Yes.
Mr. Lytle?
Yes.
Mr. Pantano? Mr. Pantano?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Mrs. Trout?
Yes.
Mr. Wingard?
Yes, ma'am.
And Mr. Blevins?
Yes. Okay, the action item is approved. Thank you. And now we'll move into the primary purpose of this morning's session, and that is the review of hold on just a minute, I have a technical issue here.
Now, I stopped the screen share so that Kirk could bring up the budget presentation.
Okay, fine. The primary purpose of today's meeting is a discussion of the current status of our 2021 budget. And I would like to say that up front, before I turn it over to Dr. Dahl and Mr. Rohrbaugh, I would like to say up front that this is a very, very difficult budget. The numbers that are contained herein were developed even prior to the onset of the coronavirus crisis, and that will, if there's any impact that will have on the budget, it is likely that'll make things worse rather than better than what we see here today. I think the goal that we should have for today as a board is not to solve in this session the balancing of the budget, but rather to give some direction to the administration as to what type of actions they might take to help us balance the budget. What is on the table, what's off the table. And so we'll go through a series of slides that give the status of the budget, and then we'll have some discussion relative to that. Now, I would caution the board members that anything that's specific to the monetary impact of things like association negotiations and other specific personnel moves, we cannot discuss those in a public session. We will have to defer those until we get into an executive session. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Dahl and Mr. Rohrbaugh.
Thank you, Mr. Blevins. And I'd also like to welcome everyone, certainly our board members, as well as our participants from our leadership team and from DAEA, to our workshop. Clearly, by way of our virtual format meeting, we have entered an unprecedented time for the district. And as we navigate today's platform, I certainly ask for your understanding. I mean, so far, so good. Recognize technology is what it is, but also for your patience as we attempt to conduct business for our district in a new and foreign way, just by way of, I don't recall a time ever in district history where we had to pass a series of policies that we just passed to conduct our business. So certainly it is a new time. To begin, there's been significant work preparing the 2021 budget and by our leadership team. I want to give a special thanks to Mr. Rohrbaugh and Mrs. Weaver, as well as our Board Finance Committee under the leadership of Mr. Hartman. Additionally, Mr. Blevins deserves great credit. He continues to bring a great deal of expertise and knowledge in refining our new sense of reality. Obviously, I'd like to thank him for his mentorship as I enter my first official budget as superintendent of schools. And boy, did I ever pick the right budget to become the first superintendent of Dallas working through. So today's presentation, as Mr. Blevins mentioned, will be broken up into various sections, including an overview. We want to spend time reviewing previous projections shared since November 2019, a summary of major 2021 budget drivers, additional projections for the upcoming budget, including expenditures, revenues, and deficit, and a culmination of board discussion related to strategies we can potentially can deploy to balance the budget. We've allotted a good chunk of time for today's workshop. So, and certainly for the board members, please, at any point in time, if you have questions, you need to seek clarity, add comment. We are prepared to stop throughout each slide of the presentation to allow for that to occur. Additionally, following today's presentation, we'll ensure, and I'll ask Mrs. Kirby to send an official copy of today's presentation to you, because there is a lot of data that will be shared in the various slides. And also, you'll notice the little red button on the top left corner. We are recording today's public session, and it will be accessible to our public. So, how about we begin? And we'll move, and Kurt's going to be navigating the slides, so we'll move to the next one. So first and foremost, when interviewing for the role of superintendent, I shared my budget philosophy throughout our time together, as well as highlighted that in my entry plan, the superintendent's entry plan. It was my belief then, and it still holds true today, that a budget must communicate educational philosophy, and that philosophy must align, support, and drive decisions made related to the budget. As we enter today's discussion and prepare next year's budget, all of us will truly be tested on our ability to align our educational and financial philosophy. And in simple terms, the task before us is extremely sobering when to get your head around. So moving forward, I will say I'm proud of the educational plan that we've developed over the past 1.5 years. And you recall that it was approved in January. Our plan is grounded in the 2020-26 comprehensive plan and really serves as our roadmap for the upcoming 6 years. So included is our vision of inspiring and creating pathways for student success, as well as key goals and tasks we hope to accomplish throughout the duration of the plan. I cannot emphasize enough that the budgetary decisions we make in the upcoming weeks surrounding next year's budget will ultimately positively, negatively, or defer important work planned for our district found in the plan. So I simply ask that as we need to remain cognizant of this fact, and you know, as we continue to focus on that educational plan and make some very difficult financial decisions, just the impact that that will have. So that I view as the easy part. As you know, and there's no secret here, the challenging part is we recognize that is to align the financial needs to support our educational philosophy. Fortunately, and I give great credit to our board, has been very good at, have a great track record of considering how the budget will impact student instruction and learning, and more importantly, the various pathway opportunities afforded to our students. Although the task has become even more challenging, I'm confident working together we'll do our best. And so, in simple terms, today's task and objective is really to find the right balance between ensuring our educational plan is funded while at the same time being fiscally responsible, and certainly a world that's rapidly changing right before our eyes. And that's kind of the task at hand. So let's begin by just reviewing the, if any questions, feel free to chime in, but we'll just start, and this should be a repeat. We'll review the 2021 projections previously shared at finance meeting starting in November. You'll recall at that time, we had a projected deficit of $1.9 million. This specific projection accounted for excess expenditures and special education costs stemming back to the 2018-19 school year. Unfortunately, these expenditures did not surface until we were too far down the lane in developing and ratifying our current year's budget. So we need to make that correction to ensure that our budget and actuals more appropriately correlate. In addition, during the November meeting, we presented several new positions, and that was for the upcoming year. And you recall this was built off of Dr. Dyer's parting comments that we currently are not staffing our school appropriately to meet the needs of our growing school district. And so that is when we provided a summary of what we viewed as the need for the upcoming year. When we go to February, we did see the deficit was really at a 1.9, from 1.9, I should say, to 2.4 million. And several drivers leading to this increase included increases in special education tuition, higher enrollment at York County School of Technology, which I will say is a good thing and part of our pathway initiative, but it does come at a cost, as well as some declining revenues that we highlighted. You'll also recall during this meeting, we also received a head nod from the Finance Committee to proceed with replacing professional employees planning on retiring or resigning their position the upcoming year. To share, Mr. Fisher and our leadership team have fully engaged in the process of replacing these teachers, and we're in the middle of the interview process. And since school has been closed due to the COVID-19 pandemic, we have placed a temporary hold on continuing to interview these candidates. I do know in speaking with fellow superintendents, and we speak on a daily basis at this point in time. Some other districts continue to aggressively move forward with interviewing and hiring candidates. So we are currently on hold. So that is one consideration as we jump into the discussion towards the end of this meeting. We should seek some clarity related, do we want to continue or not continue that process in light of where we are financially. So then we jump to March, which is the most recent projection, and it was fairly status quo, except to assist with balancing the budget. At that time, we removed all the positions that were proposed, except for the full-time custodian for Loganville Springfield Elementary School that will be coming online next year. I will say this decision is not taken lightly, and we had even further conversation with our leadership team. And we still do believe strongly, and at the minimum, the need to add an elementary assistant principal position as well as an assistant special education director. I will emphasize that's not in the budget, but it is certainly something that if we had to prioritize those positions, those two are critical just based on the enrollment and growth we've experienced at the K-3 level as well as special education. So certainly as we work through the budget, we're going to have to determine the best balance to continue to grow our organization in a time when enrollment continues to rise versus preparing for a bleak financial future. And that is certainly the challenge. So the next slide is kind of what's changed the world. And, you know, just when we thought in March we had some semblance of clarity related to our budget deficit, COVID-19 hit our community and nation, and certainly brought a great deal of uncertainty related to our district's financial future. With hard to predict sources of revenue and expenditure ahead, it complicates a true vision of our projected deficit. And I think Mr. Blevins did a nice job of emphasizing that before we started. This will be an essential part of our discussion today, and that's why instead of presenting a solidified administrative recommended budget, we need to look at, you know, and determine what we view as a team projected long-term lens on the matter, which will have a dramatic impact on our strategy. So again, the hard part will be to ensure our educational philosophy is preserved while also taking the needed steps to ensure long-term financial stability. And those two things are at balance. And as to say again, this is a sobering task and it's going to be difficult to find what we can deem as an acceptable balance moving forward. So, and today is complicated because we can't sit here having great faith in our projected revenues and expenditures. And I think it would be irresponsible if we did not acknowledge the impact of the current epidemic on our financial future. So although the pandemic has caused us to radically consider how we educate students during a period of school closure, the same mandate from PDE is in place requiring us to pass a budget no later than June 30th. And in talking with different legislatures, superintendents, various professional organizations, there's been no discussion whatsoever about delaying that requirement of the district. So we don't see any relief mandate in sight. We're still having to pass a budget by June 30th. So in short, we're going to have to pass a budget without fully understanding the ramifications. And I think Mr. Hartman said it well in his recent message. It's in our best interest to rally behind and have faith in the projections presented during our March 12th finance meeting, but also continue to keep an open mind that revenues and our expenditures may dramatically change over the course of time. So with that said, what I'd like to do at this point is turn it over to Mr. Rohrbaugh, and he's going to review a few sections, starting with budgetary drivers. But before we do that, is there any comment or question just on kind of that preamble, just a review of where we came from before we jump into some of the specific numbers at hand? Ron, you're still on mute, just so you know.
Sorry about that. Relative to the discussion that you just had, or the comments you just had regarding the uncertainty of that the coronavirus places upon the budget moving forward, it would, now this runs counter to attempts to balance the budget, but it strikes me that if ever we were going to have a significant budgetary reserve, this is probably the time to talk about that, because we don't know what form it will take in the form of decreased revenues, additional expenses, or what. But if we wanted to be have a budget that at the end of the day is somewhat reliable, then we probably ought to provide for that unknown in some fashion. So just something to keep in mind as we move through the discussions.
Yep. No, I think that's a very fair comment. And in talking with a number of superintendents trying to do the exact same thing, there's just so many unknowns. So I think your point is well stated.
Dr. Dahl?
Yes.
I'm not suggesting we do this, but as a new member, my question is, you suggested that there's been no communication thus far regarding the June 30th budget deadline. Right. If we were to not pass a budget by the June 30th deadline, what, if any, are the ramifications that come along with that? And again, I'm not suggesting that we do that. I just don't understand the ramifications associated with that deadline.
Kurt, can you weigh in on that piece?
Offhand, I'm not particularly sure what the driver of that would be. You know, what our ramifications would be. I think I'd have to consult with legal. I'm not sure if Mr. Saltanik's on or not right now. I think he's something we will check in with about what happens if we don't pass a budget. I would guess that we're not able to expend any money at that point, would be my first thing. But again, that's something we can definitely talk about.
Yeah, we can, we'll dig into that, Tony. We've never been on the naughty list, so we don't know what the ramification is, but I think it's a fair question. We'll get more legal counsel on it. I wrote that down.
Thank you.
As long as the administration would be subject to fines or imprisonment and not the board, maybe we should have that discussion. I'm just kidding.
I was just going to say also that it's not unlike every year in that respect, where we're expected to pass a budget many, many times before the state puts their cards on the table. So it's a fair question, Mr. Pantano. I agree with asking the question because I'm always interested in what's the fine. But fact is, like a lot, it's just like every other year where we're not going to know and we're going to be expected to pass a budget without knowing a lot of things.
Yeah, I agree. I appreciate you guys asking the question. It's just, if there was a year to be on the naughty list, I just, as difficult as it is, I'd like to know the answer. If it's not difficult to find out. Thanks, Kurt.
I'm sure our legal counsel can tell you, but I would imagine it does have, to Kurt's point, something to do with us kind of freezing our budget and not allowing to expend, but we'll find out.
Okay.
Sounds also like there's some penalties that get tacked on to us. What those penalties are, I don't know, but.
Again, just for the record, I'm not advocating that at this point. So, thank you.
If I can, just a quick comment on your summary, Dr. Dahl. Thank you for the clarification of York County technology being enrollment an issue, not a cost issue. I think that's good for communication moving forward.
And that increased enrollment, I might add, is consistent with our pathways philosophy.
Yeah, you bet. And that's something, I mean, just take that as one example. And it's a great example when you look at the balance between financial or educational philosophy, where we're all in. In my opinion, not sending enough students to that that great location. But there is a financial cost when we do send students. And it's not that they're inflating their budget by any means, but there's just a seat cost that we have to pay. And we want to, you know, that would be great to make that a priority. However, we're going to have to find some balance. And if we can only fund it to a certain level, that has an impact on educational philosophy and opportunity. So, thank you. Any other comments or questions before Kurt jumps into some of the numbers? And we will, Kurt, you may want to just ask if there's questions before we go through each slide, because this is the first time many board members are seeing this. So we want to make sure there's a lot of information to absorb.
Will do, Dr. Dahl. So there's a number of drivers that we saw through putting together this budget for 2021. So we're going to jump through a number of them here. Again, I think as we all know, anybody that's been around, special ed costs continue to be an issue. Healthcare claims, alternate ed placements, cyber charter school tuition, transportation, school of technology enrollment. So, and we have just a number of charts to show you where these numbers have gone, where they've been, and kind of look at things in a different perspective. So this first chart here, and this is one that's actually in the budget book, but again, where we've gone from special ed. So you can see back here in 11-12, you know, we were spending approximately $9.2 million for special ed. And we were getting from the state back in reimbursement approximately $2.4 million. As you see over the life of this, you know, over these approximately 10 years, you know, we've gone up to about 2.8, 2.7, 2.8 out here in the end. But again, our expenses have grown much more compared to what that is. So we typically talk about this as a funding issue with the state. And again, it's not nearly keeping up with what we feel it should at some point. So. Any questions on this chart?
Is it, am I correct that the 1920 column there, which is budget, is, at least according to your projections, significantly lower than what the actual is going to be?
Correct. I expect that actual to probably be more around 15.5. But again, so it just shows you how far, you know, unfortunately we missed the mark. Back when we were building the 1920 budget, and how much it changes, and then how much we're trying to catch it up here in 2021. So,
Mr. Rohrbaugh, I asked this question before, and I don't remember the answer. We show this chart annually in the budget book, although I think it's come to light that this isn't necessarily the true full cost of special education based on the AFR?
Correct.
This is a question for the finance committee to take up and to discuss with you and administration, but is it time for us to begin looking at a full cost of the special education program rather than this chart, which leaves what could be a significant percentage off the table?
Again, I think what Mr. Pantano is referring to is in the AFR, there is a supplementary table at the back of the AFR that breaks out things like transportation, guidance, health services, nursing services that gets accounted kind of. And basically what we do is we take a ratio. Simple math is basically we take a ratio of kids that are in special ed compared to what our enrollment is at that time. And that's what the factors we put across. It adds in legal costs and stuff like that, because sometimes with special ed, you know, we get into the process and we see some high legal costs when it comes to special ed cases. So I think that's what he's referring to for the other board members. He's kind of referring his question to.
Just to clarify here for the other board and, you know, in reference to Mr. Pantano's question, what is included in these costs? Is this just salaries and benefits, or what's included in these numbers?
This is anything that's in the 1200s that we report in this slide. It doesn't get into all the other ancillary costs like I had broken out and talked about. So again, even though we showed that the number of the budget might be 16, you know, if you add in probably what's in the budget book and or in the AFR number, you're probably closer to 17, 18, maybe even $19 million in a given year. So it basically shows the burden that, you know, we're put under. And we really have very little relief from it. Again, my opinion, the benefit is on the families, especially when we get into a legal situation, compared to due process and stuff like that. So if we're behind the eight ball and we're fighting to basically say that we've done nothing wrong, in all cases, it's these advocates and it's the families that kind of have the upper hand in these cases.
And I believe for Mr. Pantano's point, I think that's ultimately something that we'll provide you the information you would like. We've historically shared it this way. If that's something, I think through the finance committee, that's the will of that group to or the board to pull additional information, we'd be glad to do so.
I think part of the challenge there is that the way it's presented is in compliance with PDE guidelines and the accounting methodologies that they require, so that we have to budget pursuant to those requirements. And if it's, I don't know how much of an ongoing effort it would be on like a more frequent basis to pull out those additional costs that are shown on the AFR. But my guess is that's significant effort to do that. So the finance committee would have to take that into account if we're going to change that.
The point I'll make on this is it's only going to inflate these costs even higher. You know, honestly, this would probably show that we've underinflated them to some degree. When you add that in, it's going to only make the chart look even more distorted. So.
I think, and just to clear up, we can probably chat about it at a future finance meeting, whenever that may be. But for today, I think the discussion could be that I think we all agree this is the base number, that there are ancillary costs, to Mr. Pantana's point, that go along with these numbers, and to what extent or what percentage we would add to this, who knows, but it is a significant cost. So,
well, the other approach would be just change it to direct costs, special ed direct costs, and then we know there's always going to be an asterisk on it.
It's a good suggestion. Yep.
Healthcare costs, I think we talk about this at every finance committee, every projection we do, where we've gone and where we've been. Going back here to 12-13 when the district was under a fully insured model, so basically we bought insurance through an insurance carrier, they paid all the claims, and they took all the risk. So you can see here we were at 6.9, we kind of dropped down, and here in 15-16, we became self-insured. So basically the district decided at that point it would take the risk of the claims, which is not abnormal for a district our size, and has become more of a proponent in the healthcare industry. Whereas, you know, under the fully insured model, you see some pretty steep increases because the insurance companies are basically taking on that risk. So you see here where we've gone the last couple of years. We continue to rise in this. We've tried to make some changes, and again, a big part of that will come part of our negotiation too with our association with the rest of our employees within the district is what is our healthcare plan look like moving forward. We've kind of started to flatten out here a little bit, but again, it's something we continue to look at, evaluate each time. And I think it's a big piece of what our expenses are related to healthcare. So,
and Mr. Orbaugh,
just a clarification, if I could, the rise in healthcare costs is not a result of us going self-insured. The rise in our health care costs is a result of a rise in our claims. And had we been fully insured, it would be probably worse than this. But the self-insurance is just a funding mechanism. The driver behind our medical insurance costs is claims.
It's a good point. The other question I had here in relation to healthcare costs, I'd be curious if our consultants, AIA or anyone else, has any kind of guidance what Corona is doing to our costs. Because on one side, we're probably going to see some costs related to testing and such. But on the other side, there may be some people that delay procedures to another year that may, you know, if someone delays it to the following year, we may see more of a spike versus the current year. So I don't expect that answer this morning, obviously, but might be something interesting over the next few weeks if those guys have a feel for what's happening.
And it's one of those things that we continue to watch. I know this past week we typically get our number from the insurance carrier on Thursdays, and our number was down from some of the previous, like you pointed out, Mr. Hartman. You know, I think some of these elective surgeries have been now pushed off. Not saying that's good or bad, but it's something that drives our costs, you know, procedures and expense. And I think people are more aware of that stuff now than what they probably ever have been before, because who wants to go into a medical facility at this point and jeopardize, you know, potentially themselves? So, any questions? We'll jump to the next slide. Alternate Ed. So this is our students that we place out. And I think going back to when Dr. Dyer was superintendent, he had a pretty firm stance on these cases of Alt Ed of, you know, zero tolerance on types of threats and behaviors and drugs that were brought into school and his tolerance for what that was. So you can see here back in 15-16, we were about 700,000. We dropped down to 695,000, but since then we've kind of spiked up. You can see here in 19-20, I can tell you we've already missed this budget number of 758. So this number will continue to climb. And you can see that's why it climbs here in the 2021 years. We continue to have students coming in with needs, sometimes higher than not, sometimes coming in already with being expelled or being placed in a facility coming into the district. There's things that we do, but just another one of those major drivers that can really jump with a couple placements or a couple move-ins. So any questions on this chart?
I have a quick question. This is nothing to do with outplacement of special ed students, right? This is just all, is this just all students who we have with discipline issues, or what students fall under this?
This is students with discipline issues.
Okay.
And some of these kids come with placements from the court system already, so.
Hey, my question would be if we had whatever that, I couldn't read what the top number was, but if we had true online learning, what would that cost to implement that? And would that offset any of the kids that we don't allow in the school system?
And Mr. Benson, to your point, we do, that would really just be a cyber program. And what we do try in many cases to any student that in lieu of an alternative education placement, we could look at a cyber placement. The challenge is it's still choice, and you know, it's a matter of meeting their needs at the same time. A cyber placement's not going to do the behavior management, putting some goals in place like we can in a alternative education placement. So at the end of the day, the family still has choice over do they go cyber or do they go into an alternative ed. But we do, as a district, when we're looking at expulsions, we often try to get students ingrained in our Dallas Town Area School District cyber program versus an external placement.
Can I ask a question quick? Back to that. Thanks, Kurt. Do you have an estimated projection of what we are looking at this year, since you said we missed that mark?
We're probably right around the 921 range. I don't foresee us, we may top out. Having, in all honesty, being out of school right now probably helps us, because sometimes in the spring times when we see some of our highest cases and in situations come up, as we like to say in Dallas Town, when springtime hits, there's sometimes some stuff that happens and students decide to make some poor choices at that point. So I would say, in all honesty, not having school the last 2 weeks plus coming up for any other potential weeks off, you know, they probably drive down this cost, because again, we were projecting that they'd be in these placements for the remainder of the year. So there's no new cases coming in, but obviously the cases that we currently have, so.
So the increase is because we didn't project high enough?
Correct.
Thank you.
Well, it does open up the question as well, and we're discussing that. For instance, for these external placements, now that school is closed, we were pushing back and saying, well, we're not paying for these placements during the school closure. But the reality now with some governor mandate and the House bill and Senate bill that was approved by the governor, we're still on the hook for paying for some of these tuitions while school is closed. So it's kind of a hold harmless clause. The same applies for some of the external cyber programs. Obviously, we're not putting new students in, but they're basing our payment structure off of what it was pre-coronavirus. So hopefully we will see some flatline. To Kurt's point, I will say, you know, certainly as a principal in the district previously and in my role as assistant superintendent, now superintendent, we've seen a large spike right around this time when the sun starts shining. So that is a little golden lining to that piece.
Kurt, that $200,000, if it holds true, that's already been calculated in the projected deficit for this year, correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
All right, let's jump to cyber and charter school tuitions. Again, these are some that Mr. Bentzel, I think, had kind of spoken about a little bit. You can see back here, kind of back in the boom of cyber and charter schools, we were at $1.2 million in expense. It dropped as low as $883,000. Then we saw a spike again coming in. And again, we'll look at some of these numbers later on, but you can see some numbers continuing to grow. You know, the cybers are given a tuition rate based on what our calculation and our numbers are. You can see here, jump back, sorry about that. You can see here it drops down here to 1.4 that we have projected, but we kind of bumped that back up for 2021. And I will say Dr. Bumstead in the high school is working, you know, pretty diligently in trying to get these students back. Problem is sometimes, again, they move into the district and we're responsible because they come in from a prior district already being enrolled in the cyber. So we become kind of the de facto person that has to pay for it, even though they've never had the opportunity to come into our schools and see what we can provide on a daily basis. So,
yeah, we also, to that point, this number, I mean, as high as it is actually curtailed based on the fact that we put a full court press on a lot of our residency investigations. I know Mr. Dyke and his office working with Mr. Altman, we make this a priority for our cyber because that number continues to rise. So just the fact that we have Mr. Dyke and Mr. Altman, you know, trying to ensure that the individuals actually live in our district, it could be a lot worse. And we still continue to make it a priority. I know Dr. Bumstead, Dr. Heffler are working on strategies we've talked previously about. And starting for next year, right before all this broke, we were with the coronavirus, we were in depth looking at that K-3 platform that we still want to continue to offer, making some recommendations that way. But it's a continual work in progress.
And the only thing I would say is those numbers are probably low, because if you get enough parents scared putting their kids back face-to-face in the classroom, you'll probably have a spike of cyber school kids leaving and going to one of the cyber schools.
Yeah. Has there been any discussion to that end? I mean, I was thinking the same thing, that if you look at how easy it is, that's not the right word, how many people are looking for alternative options for their children at home right now? You think some of them are going to stay in cyber school even when this passes, like in the upcoming school year?
Yeah, that's the golden question we have to ask. And I've been discussing that with superintendents. My concern, you know, what's the outcome of what we're currently dealing with? You know, as an educational culture community outside of Allstown, does this in essence create a new norm where there's greater comfort now with families balancing online education? Does this, you have students that are hooking into it and like some of the flexibility? So I think it's a tremendous question. It's one of those we don't have an answer to. If I had to give a professional judgment, I think we would see an increase in students looking at this option, especially if they're off for the remainder of the year and this becomes their, in essence, their new norm. And that's why I think our Dallastown program is more important than ever. And the blessing I think we have out of this that we'll see long-term, our system is also going to be a lot more equipped to offer flexibility, and that concept of hybrid instruction, you know, seat time plus online learning. I think our teachers are getting a full dose of that starting here this morning at 8:30, and we'll continue to refine and become better as an organization, which can help capture some of those increases. But it's an excellent point, and I think that's long-term. We're going to be talking about it to Mr. Bentzel and, you know, Mr. Wingard's comments.
And ask a quick question. This isn't financial related. It just made me think about it while we were talking about our own cyber. has our own cyber students been, they didn't see a stoppage of work, did they? I mean, how did that work when we closed the brick and mortar, but we still had the cyber going on?
Yeah, there was the first two, and it's hard to believe, it seems longer than that. We're only through the first 2 week window since we've been closed. We're back here. This is the start of the third week this morning. There was a cease and desist from the governor for all external cybers and all schools in York County. Everything went dark and it was shut down. So our students, in essence, did close. They could continue with on their own self-pacing, because ultimately in our program, they're assigned certain expectations and they work through it more independently. So some of those students did continue, but we did not have any supports in place because we were legally, under our understanding, not permitted to do so. That was the same for external cyber schools, more independent programs, but that begins, we're fully ramped up again today, starting this third week, as well as these external programs. So it's back to normal starting today for all cyber.
I've also noticed what appears to be increased marketing and advertising on the part of the for-profit cyber schools.
You bet. It's a cottage industry right now. And not only just that, but just online supports. And I mean, I think any principal in the room can attest, they've received dozens of emails just from different platforms willing to help and from a distance learning perspective. But you're correct. There's a lot of people that are pouncing on this opportunity, a lot of businesses pouncing on this opportunity for online learning.
Okay, we'll jump to the next slide. Transportation costs, again, going back to 15, 16 where we were at about 3.8. We've kind of climbed over that time to 4.4, 4.5. Again, another area that potentially we would have missed the budget, and I kind of put that as an asterisk at this point. But then where we see it going for 2021, and again, just for everybody's knowledge, we're required, if we offer transportation, we're required to provide it to all. And as we see, you know, a number of these homeless situations, placements, you know, trying to transport kids around. And in all honesty, we haven't really increased our bus, but it's all these other alternative transportations that we have to provide to kids during the school day to get them from point A to point B that are really starting to drive some of these costs. I think we do a pretty good job related to ensuring that our buses are full. But there's the other side of that, which is the unique transportation vans. So currently right now for 1920, we probably would have missed this mark, like I said, but with some of the changes and talk that we've had, you know, we've kind of suspended all payment to transportation. There's nothing that requires us, although there's an option to provide reimbursement to our transportation carriers during this time of the corona pandemic. It's not something that we've jumped into. With that said, there's a corresponding correlation to this, is that next year we will see a drop in our revenue related to transportation subsidy. And there's been chatter, even at the legislative end, about what that's going to look like. You know, will they actually take money away from us because of that drop? But we're reimbursed based on what we spend in the previous year. So currently what we're getting revenue for in 1920 is based on our 18-19 expense. So next year's, if this year's expense is down, next year's revenue should also go down. So that's something we have to talk about, and something that's probably one of the biggest probably drivers in next year's budget also at this point is how do we continue to offer this side of it? And I know it's not the easiest. I know just in quick math, you know, we estimated that if we didn't transport for the remainder of the year, we'd save approximately $1.1 million. So there's substantial dollars here, but it's just something that we need to be aware of. So,
and I think we will, because last week there was some clarity when the law was passed here in Pennsylvania. We do still have the option locally to make that decision for our contracted service. But I do think that you'll see become more of a political discussion, and we may have to, you know, have some further dialogue as a board on do we not. But I think to Kurt's point, I want to make sure everyone understands what he just shared. basically what he's saying is that we're going to save some money this year, but next year's, you know, funding we receive from the state is going to be lower based on the fact that we didn't use as much service. And that's an important piece. And Kurt, what percent do we get back? You want to share that?
Yep. So on average, we get about 47% back from the state. So if you take that into account, you know, let's say we spend $1 million, we get about $475,000 back from the state in reimbursement for that side. So again, that's where we looked at it from a fiscal end and decided that, you know, it made more sense at this point to go for the expense side, which is the savings of the 1.1, rather than go through and try and get that reimbursement in the future years, which again isn't always guaranteed, but it's something that's out there. So
hypothetically, you said let's just save till the end of the year about a 1.2, you said?
Let's just say 1.5, because again, we've got, let's say for all the, because again, we've got bus, or we've got all the other van transportation that's done through our school express and through the LIU that all gets submitted to the state for reimbursement. So let's say we save 1.5, you know, you're looking at potentially a drop in revenue of about $700,000, unless the state makes some type of change, it decides to change its course. You know, as we've found over the last 2 weeks, it seems like as a new problem comes about, we're able to find there's some type of legislation that ends up correcting that. So it originally started with the pay of individuals, and then it went to the PEASER side of people getting credit. There's just been a number of those issues right now. And again, this one's more down the road, but it will potentially have an impact on the 2021 budget.
You're saying what we don't use is a true savings this year?
Correct.
So then what you're telling me, we should save 40% of that and don't spend it, or save all of it and don't spend it?
Yeah, in all honesty, Steve, we would save all of it and not spend any of it.
Okay.
But we'd be on the hook potentially next year for 47% of it and less revenue.
Or but if we're not spending it, we don't need the
it offsets. Yep, you're exactly right.
All right.
But you really can't transfer it from one budget year to the next, can you?
Now, what will happen is it would basically sit in fund balance. You know, let's say we had a positive year or a net year. It would sit there, and then basically we'd have to use the additional expense there. So
in reality, that shouldn't drive anything on the budget next year if we don't spend it.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Dr. Dahl, this is probably a question for you, and you may not have an answer at this point as things seem to be changing by the hour. I understand what Mr. Rohrbaugh is saying in terms of the potential revenue loss next year, but this decrease in spending is artificial. It's not an actual decrease in spending. It's a forced reduction. Are the superintendents of your county lobbying our elected officials to address? I mean, it's one thing to wait for them to discover this is a problem, but are we ahead of the curve? Are we lobbying them to say, look, you can't look at 1920 spending for transportation subsidies. You have to look at the year prior because, you know, you forced us to shut down.
Yeah, and I will say we've in general terms talked about it. We just received clarity at the end of the week with the passing of this bill. And unfortunately, Mr. Pantano, what we have is a lot of differing views on the matter, I think, across the county. And I think a lot of it goes back to the contracts that are, you know, being required. There are a large number of districts. I think the majority of districts are continuing to fully pay their transportation contractor based on the fact the way that contract was listed. So the bulk of the York County school districts have listed in their contract that they're guaranteed, the contractor, a bus provider, is guaranteed 180 days of service. So in essence, they're still continuing to pay their bill. So the subsidy issue that you bring up really is not an issue for them. They want that to continue because they're going to get money back next year. Where in fact, a number of smaller number of districts like ourselves, and keep in mind, as a review, we're in this with our contractor with Central, West York, and York Suburban. we're all four districts at this point in time are electing just simply not to pay. But we don't make up the mass of the other York County districts that are. So we can rally for it, but I think the challenge with that rally will be we're a small number compared to other districts that are continuing to fully pay and want that money back next year. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I would add, not to jump in, but to jump in, I would add that across the state, there's still a lot of districts that operate their own transportation. It's a surprising number. I learned that at the PSBA conference. So if you look at the state law where the state's making districts continue to pay employees, that includes their busing. So long story short, this is our issue, but I think the point Dr. Dahl's making, I think he made it well, but just put a fine point on it. I think we're a small number statewide. So I personally, we'll see what happens. I don't expect much action from the state just because we're a small number. The state's pretty good at fixing things where they don't have to spend the money, where the school districts have to spend it. But this is one of those cases where we're a small number. I don't think we're going to get relief, but that's just my opinion. It could change hourly, as we all know.
Say we would get relief, that'd be like double dipping.
Yeah. We'll continue to push it though, Mr. Pantano. And we've had frequent conversations with, we have a good advocate with Krista Phillips Hill and Mike Jones. I think politically they're going to be caught trying to get something approved because of there's so much disparity on this specific topic district to district. But I agree with your approach, and I think it makes sense to continue to advocate for it.
To be honest, in with the business manager side, I'm surprised how many districts did have a minimum day clause in their contract. In honesty, we were probably fortunate, but I think that's something we probably, the next time that our agreement comes up for a renewal, I think that's something we'll probably expect to see come into play based on these circumstances this time, is that, you know, you see some type of minimum day payment in those contracts, so.
Yeah, we may see some differing view with the three other districts we work with Reliance on. With this latest legislation that came out last week, because they're recognizing getting some money back for subsidy, that may change their tune. And we'll certainly keep you abreast of that. But this is going to be a fluid topic, I have a feeling, between now and the end of the year.
And just to be clear on that, at this point, the school board has empowered our superintendent to deal with this in what he views to be the most judicious manner. So we previously empowered you to do that.
Yep. Thank you. And just so to be clear on my role on it and view, we're going to continue not to pay. And if that changes, I'm going to first bring that forth, but that's where I stand for the remainder of the year. Other districts start to change their strategy, we'll have further conversation.
Next slide, and again, we'll have some more information on this later in the presentation, but just York County School of Technology. We saw an increase in enrollment here in 1920 from 117 to 135. Part of that was was York City decreased enrollment by 67 students, which opened up student slots there for other schools to send. We were a big, if you want to say it, we were a big winner in getting those slots, as we got an additional 18 slots out of that. But that has a cost like we had talked about previously. So again, you're looking at about $12,500 per student that we spend there, which makes up that additional money that we're going to spend. But that's just an area that, you know, as we continue with our pathways, I think that's the direction we want to continue to go. But like Dr. Dahl said, at some point we may need to cap this from an expense side. So,
and you'll see this is really an anomaly that came out, and we'll share some historical data. But again, to Mr. Rohrbaugh's point, it's a point we're going to have further discussion on as a group moving forward.
All right, revenue side. Again, we looked at these back at the March Finance Committee meeting. But again, I thought it was good stuff to review with the group again and as a whole. You know, these three drivers of real estate tax, interim real estate tax, and delinquent real estate tax, enough of real estate tax there, but they become on the local side and are the biggest drivers for us is what we see. So looking at our budget historically on real estate tax, and this is part of what we're trying to correct here, as you'll see out here on the difference, so what was budgeted to what we actually got, we've been trending always behind on this. We've never met the mark. And again, that's something we estimate. You can see here out to the right column what our collection percentages have been. And you can see it was 95.5% here in 16-17, but we've been as high as, you know, 96.5 is kind of what we're trending on right now. Funny thing that we look back on and talking last week was, you know, where did we stand back when we had the recession in 07, 08, and 09? We were actually in the 97% then. So it was like people were willing to pay more of their taxes then, probably because there wasn't, you know, as much of a penalty and this stuff getting turned over to the county than what you would expect. So I think people probably valued their money more now than what they did back then. It was kind of odd to see that. But we're trying to correct this here for the 2021 budget. So, you know, again, we want to get this back that basically we're even each year and not kind of running this at a deficit. Like we've shown here has been the case in some of these prior years. So we've started to get that kind of corrected more. As you see this go down, we cut it in half. Our goal for 2021 is to get this to zero so that, you know, what we're budgeting is what we're actually getting. So,
yeah, and I do believe, just to chime in, I think this is going to be a countywide discussion with the York County commissioners. I have spoken with Julie Dietz-Wheeler. She's the president of the commission, and I know that's it's a major concern for them. That's their majoring source of revenue as well. So I would hope we're going to receive some clarity in the coming weeks from York County as what this real estate tax, and Kurt mentions the penalty, perhaps something is done that way to help ease the payment of tax or to entice. But this is something that will be a little bit fluid as well. And we really, Kurt, in your opinion, we're not going to have a true sense of this until what time next year?
Till basically December of next year when we finally turn over real estate tax over to the county. So basically, you know, people start paying that. We send out bills in middle of July. You know, people start paying almost immediately, but they run out. We don't turn them over to the county and know the final number till the end of December of next year, and even a little bit longer than that. So, you know, we'll have a good picture next year at this time. I think why the county's talking at this point, why it's a big deal to them, is they're currently have sent out bills for their for calendar year 2020. So to them, you know, this is a huge impact. Hopefully by the time we get to sending out our bills, it's not as big of an impact. Hopefully some things have started to turn around, but I foresee that there will be some type of adjusted number here. So,
just to put a finer point on that, Kurt, you're saying your research from the Great Recession, actually collection percentage was a little higher. Because that's counterintuitive, but it's interesting.
Correct. Yeah, I was actually surprised too when I saw it, and you kind of dive into it. So, All right, we'll look at here interim real estate tax. So, just to kind of refresh with the whole group here, interim real estate taxes for bills that are issued basically after July 1. So, let's say you put a deck on your house in the springtime. Typically what will happen is from the county and from the school district and from all the municipalities is you'll get a bill that basically for that additional improvement, because you weren't billed on it at July 1 when bills were sent out, you get this interim real estate tax bill. If you build a new house and once that, let's say that house comes online after July 1, you would get an interim real estate tax bill. So you can see here back in 2014-15, we were getting about $280. We saw it grow to 380, then we saw it spike up to 952, then we saw it drop down, we saw it go up. So again, this is a really huge yo-yo for us. I think is one that we continue to watch and kind of see what's going on is the project over at Apple Hill with the Wellspan property. There's two big additions that are going on there with a cancer center going on the existing Apple Hill site, and then to the south of that, there's the cardiac center that's going on, basically like I call the triangle piece of land between Grantley and George Street. So, again, those depending on what they are. Again, we're not at this point kind of basing these that they'll be taxable in the future year, but something that we need to continue to watch and see, because we could see a spike on this one depending. We could see, though, other properties kind of cease and desist. I know there's been discussion at the state level about, you know, residential properties continuing to be allowed to build. I know we've got some guidance related to our construction project being allowed to continue. So I think we'll have to continue to watch this. We could see a drop in other properties, in smaller things like, you know, pools or decks or improvements to homes. But you could see new properties still continue to come online. And we've averaged
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, we see on average there about 575 when you take these couple years together. So again, some years we're winners and some years we're losers on this one.
Relative to the WellSpan construction, have you received any indication of their view of the taxability of those properties?
So I've inquired with the county to try and get their take on it. At this point, they won't say heads or tails. They're basically waiting until the property's done. From my perspective, I'm struggling to see it, how it classifies as a hospital compared to some of the other units. But again, it's something we continue to watch and monitor as they continue to grow and build. I think the project there, the cardiac center is supposed to be slated to be done by the end of the calendar year of 2020. So we could see this come online during next year's budget at some point.
You know, if I could just make a point on this particular thing, because I know it was brought up in finance committees and also with some individual conversations with board members on this interim tax number. To your point, Mr. Robert, you know, there's decks and swimming pools, but the volatility probably here is a couple large properties coming online or not coming online is going to swing this number dramatically versus a lot of individual. Is it safe to say that, or?
Yeah, most certainly. You know, for some of you that are aware about the project that's going on there almost across from Leaders Heights, you know, the townhouses or condos that were built there, a lot of these are driven by bigger things. But again, you know, let's say a house, there's a number of houses going on out towards past Windridge right now. You know, those still have some substantial value to us based on what their assessed value is that's coming back to the district. So,
Kurt, just to repeat, what are you proposing?
We have about a $550,000, I think, about in interim real estate taxes. So it's more or less showing you what we're keeping status quo. We've not incorporated those WellSpan properties or any of these other improvements that we've talked about in the coming years. So
that's an example, though, for a board. If you take exception to that number, we can have some further discussion as we're developing the budget and final administrative recommendation. But again, around $550,000 is what is being budgeted in the budget book.
Mr. Rohrbaugh, I'm sorry if you said this and I missed it. On your slide, the 1920 number, the 522, that's the budget number, right?
Correct.
What are you projecting that really comes in at? Or I'm sorry if you already said it.
No, I didn't say it. I know it was in our March or latest update. I can pull that out after we get off and give you what that number is. I think we're projecting right around that at this point. I don't think we saw a big jump, but I'll be able to pull that out pretty quick here once we get off. I can look at some screens.
That's fine. I don't want you to do a little extra work. I just thought maybe it was on your sheet there. Thank you.
Okay, the other one we looked at, and again, this one has a caveat, the screen, not the last screen on interim, but the actual real estate, delinquent real estate taxes. So delinquent real estate taxes is once a tax bill is not paid by December 31st of a year, it gets turned over to the county and it becomes the county's responsibility to collect those outstanding. So they're responsible for, you know, sending out the mailers, going after these people. So the first column here looks at what was turned over in some of the prior years and then what they collected. As you'll see here, in some cases, like 2012-13, we turned over 1.1 million. We collected 1.3. So in that case, we were to the positive $220,000. In other years, we've turned over less and we've collected more. So again, it's just a matter of how that all breaks out. It's some years we are winners, some years we are losers on this case. Again, you can see here from a total standpoint, we had $8.4 million that we turned over, and we've collected 9.8. On average, again, we've turned over 1.2 and we've collected 1.4. So what we turned over was about $1 million. We've typically trended in the right way. And the 1 year I'll highlight here is 17-18, where we had a huge property that set of properties that got paid off. And we saw a big influx of cash in the month of June of about $800,000 on delinquent real estate tax. So again, the county's done a better job trying to get these properties up to date, but you can see there what the collection side is. So. Any questions related to that?
I still struggle with, I understand that the, and it's probably a function of the economy that the amounts turned over in the current year, the 1920 year, are less than your average. That said, wouldn't there be an offset to that in normal real estate taxes? The amount that was not delinquent and was collected, wouldn't there be an offset in the non-delinquent real estate taxes?
I would somewhat think so, but there isn't. You know, again, like I said, you know, we've got to take it and term it as delinquent. In some cases, some of these properties go outstanding for 4 or 5 years. If you look at the current county listing, which is out there on their website, it's over 1,300 pages for all the school districts and municipalities in the county. You know, they've got a lot of stuff up to date. There's not many of the properties that have a 3, 4, 5 year run out. They're basically just a year behind at this point. And that's a question I've asked the county on collection side. So.
Okay.
So let's jump into projections for the 2021 budget. Again, we're going to look at revenues, expenditures, and then kind of where we see the deficit at this point. So expenditures here by category. Draw your attention here to the big blue area. This is all of our salaries. This pays our professional staff, our administrative staff, our support staff, along with any other type of subs or things that we pay people for. So again, out of $113 million in expenses, $50 million of that is just paid in salaries. You jump across to the big orange area here, which is the benefits side. We spend approximately $31.6 million in benefits. So that's not only healthcare, that's the PEASER side of it. And again, that's the gross of PEASERs, not the net of that. So there's some pretty big dollars there. And again, you can kind of go around there and see where our other biggest items are. On the 800s and 900s here up here in the corner, those are related to our debt for the most part. And we'll kind of talk about that when we look at the expenditures here in a second. From a percentage side, again, we're at, you know, almost 73% of our budget is tied up in salary and benefits, you know, in this big piece of pie. The other stuff, some of the stuff is discretionary and we have control over, but a large majority, I would say in all honesty, you know, 10% of our budget is what we can really influence because of what we do. The other 90% is already basically accounted for or basically opens up as soon as we open the doors on day one, from student needs, or staff needs. So I think that's something that, you know, for anybody new to this is a big driver. We're not unique in that sense. Most school districts are in the same boat as we are, but something to keep in mind. So kind of drill it down here and kind of break it out for you. And again, we'll send this out afterwards and post it on the website because I know the numbers here will jump around, but I think it's something to look at. We look at regular instruction. Here's what we spent in 18-19. And again, we've tried to do our best over the last couple of years of getting back to what our actuals are, which is benefited us to some degree, but it's also hurt us because as actuals change and our enrollments increase, you know, it's hurt some of our projections because we haven't had the amount of buffers that we've had previously. So you can see here in 1920 what we spent year to date. We spent approximately almost $66 million so far. In 1920, here's what we think that we're going to end up anticipating spending. And then here's what we budget for in 2021. So first thing that jumps out here is why are we actually spending less? Jump back here. Why are we spending less in 2021 or projecting that we're going to spend less when we spend more in 1920? So I'll draw your attention down here to the 5,000 level. There is a big bond payment that gets paid. So the money is coming from the bond fund that'll get transferred over to the general fund. It's approximately $2.4 million. So that's why that number is inflated there. But you can see, you know, what our stance is on that. So I know this is a lot of information to kind of ask for questions, but just something to kind of look at and something I would recommend anybody to kind of jump into and should be explained pretty well in the budget book as we break down each one of these categories in great detail. So jump to the next slide. We talked about expenses. Let's talk about revenue. Again, this driver here is on the local side, in basically in the terms of property or real estate tax, which those bills go out middle of July once the budget has been approved. You can see here mostly that money, again, out of that $80 million, about $68 or $69 million comes from real estate tax. So it's a huge driver here and makes up a large majority of our revenue on that side. The other big area that we talked about is here on state side. So the state revenue, we're looking at next year getting projected about $30 million. There's a couple variables here that need to be discussed and kind of need some eventual direction from the board on is that, you know, we talked about the transportation side, so I won't beat that horse again. But what I will say is on the actual basic ed and special ed subsidy, we've accounted for, so what we take into account, and I'll show you here in another slide in a second, is what we budgeted for compared to what the governor said. Jump here to also here on the federal side, we get approximately just under $1 million in federal resources for our Title I and Title II programs. And then here in the 9,000s, we get about $400,000. And that's mostly made up of our line of credit that we have with York Traditions for the Chromebooks that we lease each year. So again, revenue by function. Again, you can see here tax-wise, this local taxes, so this makes up not only real estate tax, it makes in earned income tax, which is another huge topic that we probably need to talk about today. And we budget about $6.1 million next year for earned income tax, but with the status of the economy, I see that us missing the mark not only in 1920, but also in 2021 is something that probably needs to be looked at pretty heavily. Down here in delinquent real estate taxes, you can see we talked about that. We've currently only received 310. Chances are we won't even get to our $1 million number that we have here currently. Earnings on investments. I think if anyone's looking at a 401 or their 403b account, everybody's seen that investment earnings have dropped dramatically during this time, and I foresee that continuing. So I see this being probably dropping back to some of our lowest points ever, back to the recession time even, of when, you know, we were potentially only making $100,000 to $200,000 a year compared to 2 years ago where we made over $900,000 in investments. So something just to keep an eye on, but it's something that's really gonna probably inflate us or deflate us coming out. And then we get down here into all the pass-throughs and state revenue in the 7,000s. And then down here at the bottom in the 9,000s is that big debt payment that comes over from the bond funds. So that's where that revenue comes in. Again, a revenue for what we anticipate in 1920 is actually lower in 2021 because of that bond fund payment. So,
Mr. Warbaugh, if you go back just one, if I'm looking at the federal sources and it's trending down. If I recall from previous years, you could enlighten me probably, but it used to be over $1 million, so it continues to trend down. Is there a reason for that? Like just a 30,000 foot reason, not a specific.
Yeah, there really isn't. As much as we work with Dr. Farid on federal programs, this seems to be a crapshoot every year. Just as we think we're going up in that, or it maintains and it drops off, and the next year it seesaws back up to being over. There really is no major rhyme or reason. As you can see there, what we got last year is not what we're expecting to get this year in the in 2021. So
Mr. Rohrbaugh, could you address why the 7,200 shows a slight drop from what's anticipated this year to what you're budgeting for next year? And it seems to me that that's counter to the projected rise in our special ed costs. So could you address that?
Let me jump to the next slide, which I think puts some of that in perspective. So we talked about state funding and something to discuss here. Typically, as we've talked about a number of times, you know, the state budget typically doesn't get passed until after our budget has been passed. Going back 3 years ago, they didn't have a budget until February, so that puts some real strain on districts, and that's why a lot of districts don't always account for the increases that is projected from the governor's side. So what you can see here is what we've budgeted for 2021 on the top line. So this is our basic ed. This is our special ed. And again, this has been part of the planning going back to previous budgets, but you can see here what the governor projected in 2021, so that we would get an increase of $10.4 million, or we'd get $10.4 million in basic ed, $3.1 in special ed. So there's a difference there of almost $500,000. So currently in this budget, we've already basically accounted for $300,000 of new money from the state based on what we budgeted for 1920. So that's part of that rise and part of the discussion, I think, is do we go to this well and take some more of this additional $500,000? My recommendation currently is not to, just because of the flux of the economy and stuff like that. So that's why you see back on that previous slide here, that's why you see that drop, because they've actually given us more money here in 1920, and some of that has been planned. That's just the way we budgeted the last couple years. But I think that's part of the discussion here moving forward from the board, is do we continue to hedge on what we know that we're going to get, or do we add some more additional money into this line item?
And I do believe, sitting as assistant superintendent for many years, there was a long-term parameter with the board, and that fluctuates year to year slightly, but we really have not gone into budget season with looking at receiving any funds from the state. And then that obviously shapes and forms as we get closer to the governor and getting a sense of where the state will be. We did deliberately put $300,000 in. Again, I would articulate this, what Kurt shared. That's something we're going to have to discuss as a board. We can lower that, we can increase it, but that $500,000 is not guaranteed money, and especially in light of what is going on around the state. You know, yesterday, reading the paper of thousands of individuals being furloughed, laid off at the state level. It's some gloom and doom from the state budget standpoint as well. And what's the ramification of that when they ultimately do elect to pass the state budget?
Just to get clarification, you're saying that in what you are projecting for our Dallas Town's 2021 budget, you are including the $500,000, or you're not including the $500,000?
500 is not included. So actually, when you would actually go back and look at what our 1920 budget is, we actually get an increase from the governor of about $800,000. I've taken 300 of that and put it into this budget projection here for 2021. But based on his figures that he came out with back in February, there's an additional $500,000 that we could put in. At this point, my recommendation is not to account for that, and just continue to use it as a windfall like we've done in previous years. But I think that's something to discuss at this point.
And do you think that the estimate that you have there is, and I know it's all fluid, but is it somewhat firm, or if you look at in light of where we're at right now with the federal government, state government going into incredible deficit spending to handle the current crisis, will the matrix for this change, given the economic impact that our current situation puts us in?
It's a good question, Mr. Wingard. I struggle to say that we're going to just maintain the same. But again, this is new uncharted territory, so I think anything's possible at this point. I could easily pull that out. You know, a very conservative model would be pull that additional $300,000 out and maintain that what we're getting in 1920 is just the same that we're going to get in 2021, which has been the state model for years, that, you know, they're not going to take money away from districts. They'll just maintain your funding. But I think that's something topic wise we probably need to discuss.
Yeah, and that was in the spirit of the law that was passed, the governor signed late last week. That was the tone of the message for school districts, that you're not going to receive less funds for the 1920 school year. That does not account, though, in giving districts more money, which is what we're talking about here, to a tune of $800,000. And what does that train? They only speak to 1920. What does that mean for 2021? That's the unknown question. So we hedged our bet on $300,000. There's another $500,000 from what was proposed, but that proposal came, you know, months before what we're dealing with now in our society and in Pennsylvania.
To Mr. Weingard's point, I think there is a distinction between the federal government and the state government, in that the federal government can essentially print money, the state government cannot. Okay, so there's a distinction there, and the state budget is going to be pretty ugly as well. So I think it's the assumption that the administration has made here is that we at least won't go backwards, but let's not count on the additional $500,000 is probably prudent at this point, unless, you know, PSBA does some pretty dramatic lobbying. I think they're going to be hard pressed to come up with the funds. Just my opinion.
I'm good with leaving this out, the $500,000 out, because I'd rather have the worst case scenario than the best case, because at this point there's no way to know. And I think we're not the only ones going to be, I mean, you think of all the nonprofit and the charitable organizations that the state helps and how bad they're going to be. It's unprecedented of how many people are going to need, how many organizations are going to need extra money. So I say leave the 500 out.
Well, to your point, Sue, the worst case scenario would be we pull the 300 we baked in. And that if they did truly flat fund us for next year, I'm comfortable leaving the $300,000 in and hedging our bet that way. But again, it's, if you want to truly talk worst case, I think the worst case would be we have $300 baked in that's not going to be available next year.
My two cents, I'm good with the $500 guess right here, because at the end of the day, we're speculating. I agree with Mr. Blevins that the state can't print money, so that's kind of known. However, the federal government has shown quite a willingness lately to print all they need. So we just had an emergency disaster declaration. The bottom line is, who knows? We might have some more clarity, hopefully by June, when we have to actually vote on this thing, we'll have some clarity. But in the meantime, I think it's probably prudent where you are.
Anyone disagree with that? Okay, there you go.
Let's jump to expenses and revenue. So again, based on our expenses of $113 million and revenue at $111 million, we're still looking at about a deficit of just over $2 million for 2021. So that's where we stand at this point. So how do we balance that budget? kick it back over to Dr. Dahl here.
Okay. And again, I think it just goes back to the simple point, the sobering job of finding that right balance. And that's the challenge at hand. So when you go moving forward to the next slide, Kurt, you know, really as deficits are occur in districts, it's the responsibility of the board and administration to, you know, try to find ways to balance. And unfortunately, those strategies are limited in scope. So what you have here is where we do find a balance is going to have to come between reductions of expenditure. And you know, that could include things such as deferring purchases to a later time, program cuts or staffing cuts with that reduction. You saw the amount in staffing, for instance, as an example, that's a large portion, bulk of our overall budget. Do we get into programs or do we look at just deferring certain things to a later point in time? Fund balance, which includes monies available to in our accounts to help balance the budget. Obviously, the shortcoming of deploying this approach is once the money's used, it's no longer available for future budgets, and we also have to make up that gap in future budget years. And then the last piece is the increase in real estate taxes. And I think it is something we have to wrap our head around today and get a semblance from the board in order to see if it is a feasible option or not a feasible option. You know, since serving as superintendent, one of the questions, you know, we continue to ask is when is the best time to raise taxes? And is it an economy that's strong or an economy that's poor? And unfortunately, when we're having this discussion, we have a crippling economy, which makes the answer to that question so much more difficult. So, but and overall, those are the three kind of levers we can look at to figure out how to fill this deficit. Move on, Kurt, then the areas that we spent time reviewing, we want to first start with areas that we do not want to consider cutting. And there's some historical data here that tells a story. And I think our district has done a great job over the last 10 years. And you really look going back to 2010-11, provides a summary, the graph does, of our building and departmental budgets over the past 10 years. Just two I want to point out, if you look particularly at the high school budget, you know, 10 years ago, having a budget of $1.2 million, just for their operation expense. And that's obviously lessened by 58% over the course of the time. The area that we've probably had the most conversation about in the last year is just with our buildings and grounds. I mean, once they had a healthy $3.5 million budget, and now they're down by 37%, which again, that's a great example of deferred expenditure. And we've had, you know, a lot of discussion on some decaying infrastructure and needs from that area, but it is attributed to how we balanced our budgets in the past was on the back of majority of these buildings and departments. So I really don't see kind of using Mr. Blevins' analogy, there's not a lot of juice left in the squeeze when it comes to taking additional funds from our buildings and departments. Go back one, Kurt. Is there any questions on that specific piece? Okay. So other areas, just moving forward, then other areas we've benefited from in the past is through, you know, the reduction of expenditures as it relates to retirees and resignations. And I think regardless of the strategy, this is something that will help us if we do believe, and we've implemented this, and I know it's a further discussion point with the board, if we can lower our salary costs by hiring individuals that are new to the profession at a lower salary. So what we have here, you'll notice positions that were vacated, and you know, we have a previous head nod on the top section. I just want to emphasize the difference. Previously, we had the first and second kindergarten at Oar Valley, the music at the intermediate middle school, and the English at the high school. That comes to a tune if we simply replace them with an estimated cost of $243,000. Since we received that head nod, just for transparency, we want to also make it noted that we have positions from retirees and resignations, the middle school PE teacher, a high school biology and math position, as well as retirement notice of our athletic director. So if we would go in replacing them, that would be an additional $44,000 to a tune. If we replace all positions at a lower salary, we'd be right around $287,000. You will recall we also have already filled, going back up to the top list, the high school history position. That was a middle of the year vacancy, so that position is filled and is not included in the dollar savings that way. Any questions on, and again, we're just showing specific teachers at this point, if we would replace them.
In the numbers that you previously showed, since there's some new items, late emerging items, is the number you have in the 243 or the 287?
Kurt, you want to speak to that?
Okay, so we've accounted for basically the savings on the top number on the previous stuff. The new stuff that's coming in, we have not incorporated into the budget book or into our projection.
So that's another $44,000. Okay, got it. Thank you.
Can I ask a question on the previous slide? I apologize. Can you just tell me how those budgets are figured out?
Are you specific to the building and department budgets, Mrs. Hausler?
Yes, sorry.
Basically, we work through a budgetary process, and that starts in the fall, where each individual building, you know, works with their subject area leaders, their department chairs, some of the other leaders in their buildings, and really tries to define what those needs are moving forward. And so the building principal ultimately comes up with a recommendation to both Kurt and myself, and then we have some conversation about what we can afford and not afford. And trim that back even further. So it's really a building-based budget, looking at what it needs to maintain, building or department, what they need to maintain, their building for the upcoming year. The challenge with the process is the process itself, that they're doing this in the fall when they're not even through the current year, and then they're projecting for the future year. So that's really, what the process entails. And I don't know if that fully answers your question or not, Mrs. Hausler.
It does. Thank you. So the 2019-2020 that you show there, is that the current for each building or does that change?
Correct. That's the current for each building.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Okay. So the other area, just in regard to these positions, they do ultimately do add the positions, teaching positions that are available. They add about a $1.1 million to our line item. If we, let's say, for instance, would not replace these positions, we feel, each of these positions are certainly worthy and the impact would be dramatic. We share this though with you because I have a feeling there's some, and where we are with our budget, I'm sure that's a question that, may be surfacing in your mind. What if we would not fill them? That gives you a sense of what that would entail. If interested, we can certainly speak, and I know we even have some principals here, the impact of not filling these positions or roles. And we could save that to a later point in time if we wanted to. But I want to give you a sense of what these positions in our budget would ultimately entail.
Dr. Dahl, just for clarification, the 1.1 number on this slide, is that on top of the 287, or are they independent, those numbers? Maybe it's Mr. Rohrball.
Yeah, they're independent. That's two separate, the 287, two separate. Yeah, they're separate.
Yeah, I just wanted to be make sure it was clear. We're not talking about 1.1 on top of the two. It's total 1.1.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Clarity. Any other questions on that? Okay. Also specific areas we've already considered, and the items have been trimmed or removed. And again, unfortunately, these already when you see that, for instance, in the 617, the first slide, that's already part of the $2 million deficit. So it's not taking away 617 from the 2 million. Let's start with in essence, the new position. It is our belief that these positions are certainly, needed. We're a growing district, but the economics are what they are, and we did remove them to help combat the deficit. You're going to notice in the first two positions, there's an asterisk. We've had a lot of discussion administratively. Unfortunately, the discussion is occurring before the budget book had to be produced for you, as well as after the budget book had to be produced. But administratively, with our leadership team, I think you're going to receive strong opinion in talking with any members of the leadership team that the elementary assistant principal and assistant director of education should be placed back in. Obviously, that conversation is going to be better served once we determine our financial strategy to address the deficit. But Dr. Dyer, when he left, his last remarks is that we are not properly, funding education here at Dallastown. And then we've pared back a number of the positions he presented to this list. And it's disheartening that we also, based on the economic times, we're also looking at pairing this to everything off except the Loganville Springfield custodian. But we'll have to have some more discussion once, and you'll hear more of that once we get a sense of the kind of parameters and threshold for the board. And when we come back to you, you may see those two asterisk positions resurface if permissible. The other area that I just want to emphasize, there's some additional, things that are unknown, as well as things that I think, regardless that of where we go, we're going to be looking to make some reduction. And I don't have a dollar value, but they're not, in addition, they're already pulled out of that $2 million deficit. We'll talk more about the teacher contract towards the end of the presentation. But the reduction in copier cost, trying to reduce color copy, that was a big ripple when we put the stop on that earlier in the, this current budget season. We're going to look to continue to do so. Conference cost, food cost, curriculum writing, and replacement of band uniforms. I will say, the challenge we're running into, just think about the advent of the school closure. We have in here a breakdown of 50% reduction of curriculum writing. But just with the closure, think about, how we have to now realign our curriculum for next year. And again, that may be something we have to reconsider based on the work that needs done for the start of next school year. And where does our curriculum in essence start? So that's part of the heavy lifting we need to do. Conference cost is another thing we're going to have to consider. It really becomes a new norm for districts, and also, some of the language specific into our contract. But we are going to try to, regardless, make some reductions in these areas, because they're really some of the last buckets we have left to cut cost. Moving on,
I'm sorry.
You bet, Ms. Hostler.
The previous slide, I'm sorry, we're always going back. Those cuts were decided based upon the projection of next year's budget. Is that correct? Okay. I just wanted clarity.
Yeah, so they've already been, obviously the teacher contracts is a big unknown, because we do not know the outcome of that. But some of those others, I think regardless, we were looking to make those cuts, and they've already been included just to try to shave off some money from the deficit.
And included in that would have been the previous slide with the teaching position and administrative positions.
Correct. Those positions are not included in the budget at this point in time.
Okay.
So it's really the $2 million deficit. In summary, you have no new positions outside of one Loganville Springfield custodian and elimination of these pieces. But I think we're going to have to, once we get some better clarity from the board, I may come back to you when we make a final recommendation based on where we are for some of these items.
Okay, thank you.
If feasible.
Hey, just a quick question. Can you hear me?
Yes, Hillary.
Okay. I know it's peanuts, but why would replacement band uniforms only be a 50% budget reduction this year?
All right, so here's what happened with the band uniforms. So in 2021, the original request for it was for $120,000 worth of band uniforms. Again, band uniforms are not cheap. I bought them previously, and they're dramatically expensive. So what I had recommended to them was, let's take a 50% cut. So basically what we would do is buy half of the uniform in the springtime. This is kind of some accounting wizardry, I like to call it. 50% of them in the springtime, and then buy the other half in basically July and August, quick, before the band season, so that they had them for the new year. Rather than taking the hit in the full 1 year of $120,000, we split it into $60,000 twice.
Got it. I was thinking you were just not going to buy them. You're going to buy half of them. So that makes sense.
Yeah, that's what the plan was there. So,
let me ask a quick question about the curriculum writing.
Yes.
Did you say the 50% budget reduction was may have to also incorporate the adjustment to the curriculum if, in fact, we have to shoehorn 200-plus days into 180 days next year?
Yeah, we're going to have to – that's just one. You know, when we created – the budget book and parameter, we had it removed. Obviously, a lot has changed in the world in two weeks. And for us, the curriculum writing, we're seeing a strong need now for that more than ever, that we may have to make some adjustments before we provide you our final administrative recommendation in order to accommodate for teachers to get together. And, you know, and just, you know, hypothetically, we're in essence losing a trimester of school. So do we need to have all teachers start beginning of the year instructing, starting with the third trimester of this year and then proceeding, which is going to cause some major curricular changes that need to occur over the next 2 to 3 years to kind of balance this out once we get back to semi-normal.
Well, instead of just a curriculum writing project, can that be incorporated into some of the contractual days that the staff have?
Yep, you bet. And that's something that I know teachers will be looking. If we do return, we have 2 days filled in on the current date of return to do some of that work. We also have, there's several from the first week that we were closed. There was about 5 days that we could look at some flexibility of providing that with teachers. So to your point, there are some days that we can use teacher contract days currently in this year's schedule to try to accomplish some of that work.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, and this is just to paint a picture. I'm not necessarily recommending this piece, but I wanted to share. So the question is, we talked about what the levers would entail. So what would happen if we don't want to utilize fund balance, or we do not want to raise taxes and are negatively impact our current program and staffing model? So, you know, I'm trying to give everyone a sense of what would we need to do administratively. And we've broken this down into two tiers, and tier one would be the area that we'd want to first consider if additional revenues are not found. And again, this is the list is profound, and we'll kind of just spend time reviewing each one. And Kirk, can you first start by talking about the special, what's baked in the special education alternative ed buffer?
Yeah, so this buffer that we have baked in is basically, let's say we have $4.5 million in expenses right now in actual expenses that we project for 2021 in special ed. We've included in this budget, because of the trends that we've seen over the last year, an additional $300,000 on top of that. So it really makes the number that we budget $4.8 million to basically counteract any type of additional needs that we see coming in. And so that's what that buffer is. Again, if we go back and take that out, what will happen is basically we're running that we get no new kids in for next year and have no new enrollments or anything like that, which in my opinion is somewhat dangerous based on what we've seen from past years. But again, it's an option that's out there. So I think my recommendation is not to go that direction, but I think that's something that can be, you know, definitely looked at if need be.
Yeah. And again, we're looking at, worst case, if we are considering no additional revenue, no program cuts, staffing cuts, this is what it would in essence be, kind of a semblance of a recommendation. The other area, it's been a pride of our district, the senior citizen tax rebate program. You'll recall several years ago, we did cut that in half. We're still expending about $125,000. We would have to look to eliminate that. And Kurt, I do believe, are we the only district left in York County, or is there one other district?
Yeah, I think there's one or two others out there. It's hard to find some of their programs, and just for everybody's knowledge, they qualify through the state. Basically, they need some assistance from the state, so based on that, that's what we use as our guide on this. So not everybody qualifies, but these are definitely our most neediest citizens that, you know, from a state level, they qualify for the benefits, and then we give them a portion of their tax bill back on our side. So,
yep. It is not a mandate that we do this. This is a local decision. So with that said, we would have to look to pare that back. The other area, and looking at, you know, 1920 to 2021, there's an overage and an increase in the B&G budget. And I think part of that just makes sense. We're trying to make up from historical limitations we've placed on the B&G budget, but we would have to bring them back to more of the 1920 calculation, shave off the 122 additional that they were looking at. And a heavy hitter here, and talked about deferred expenditure, would be the capital reserve fund projects. Just basically strip that $450,000 away, which would again defer the inevitable work that needs to occur. So if we had to prioritize, and with no additional revenues, no cuts of staffing, no fund balance utilization, that's where we would, in essence, go for the tier one. I think when you get into tier two, it's equally alarming. And this consists of, you know, what I consider low money, big impact items. And I think this is where we would certainly start to have a tremendous negative impact on our students and some of our constituents. Starting with music teacher replacement, even though I said no staffing, this would be an area that we would have to look at. You'll recall we preserved a music teaching position several years back. Some of the things would just be deferred payment with smart panels. You're going to have in our K-3 level particular, they're up for, we've already sliced this in half. We'd have to take the remaining money to not include any type of smart panels. Loganville Springfield does have that in their current building project. So you would just see some discrepancy between the elementary schools that way. Cameras, again, it's just a deferred cost. We less $25,000. CAD and 112 classroom projects, just technology that's at the end of life that we would consider not replacing. And obviously the risk is if we have some equipment error. The remaining band uniforms, I know Kurt just spoke to that based on Hillary's question, that would just be removed altogether. So we would go without band uniforms and have to defer that. You get into travel costs with basically saying there's no travel and no conferences or workshops for next year. We would just have to set that administrative priority. Student activities, you're getting into, you know, programs for kids and just deferring that. Athletics, we continue over the course of several years have gone to athletics and asked them to continue to trim. We would do the same thing at about a 10% of their budget with $15,000. Professional development, curriculum writing, we've already had some discussion, but that would limit what offerings we could offer our staff, as well as some of the curriculum writing. Just we would have to, you know, again, do our best in being creative using the instructional days permitted in the contract. Field trip busing, I know this was a discussion when Dr. Nicholson was on our board. We would just, in essence, look at eliminating all field trips for the upcoming year. Because we would not be able to provide busing for them. Intramurals, really is a major component of our middle school program, engaging kids after school. We'd have to lessen that. And then we're also looking at activity buses. We run two activity buses after school that we would, in essence, have to pull back to a tune of about $79,000. So that would give us another savings around $805,000.
$805,000. And if you go to the next slide, Kurt, then just between the two, you're looking at about a 1.8. That still does not get us to that 2 million dollar threshold. So we'd have to either continue to make some cuts or look at some utilization of fund balance. But again, just to give you a sense, you know, it really comes down to revenue streams and how we're going to be creative in trying to determine what the revenue entails. So I want to have Kurt, one of the levers we talked about earlier is the use of fund balance. It's not a recommended strategy, but just to give you a sense of what that would entail. So Kurt, if you want to speak to the to that piece.
Yeah, so we, during the course here, I wanted to go over where we were fund balance wise. And I think, again, as I've heard this fund balance, and you'll see here back in 5-6 where we were at as a district, we were at 6.5, almost $6.6 million in fund balance. There was a period there just as the beginning of Act 1 came into play. And again, that's where the state came in and basically said, this is how much you can raise taxes. Over and above that, you have to apply for exceptions. You know, they made us jump through hoops. Prior to 5-6, or prior to 6-7, when Act 1 came into play, you can raise taxes as much as you wanted. So that's where you saw some fund balances start to get out of whack a little bit. You can see here in that 3-year period, we jumped up to $14.5 million in fund balance. But over the years, we've continued to decrease down, you know, each year, little by little. Part of it was by design, I think, by the board. And part of it is, but as you can see here in 1920, what we projected back before the coronavirus crisis, you know, we were looking at potentially taking a $2 million loss in 1920. So that would have put our fund balance down at $7.4 million. So a pretty big drop. It's starting to become an alarming number. Again, if we don't know what future years are going to be, it's hard to hedge our bet that, you know, we should utilize fund balance to balance next year's budget, because I think that only puts us in a crippling position for future years. Now, in saying that, you know, this current year, like we had talked about just on transportation savings, you know, this fund balance could go up. I could see this going up $2 million. I could see it going down $2 million. I think that's just what we're under right now economy-wise. And we're trying to let this play out as best we can. But it's getting to the point that it's not my professional recommendation from a financial side to utilize fund balance in this case, because it is starting to get pretty dramatic. You know, at $112, $113 million budget, you know, we're starting to get to a point where we're only having about 5 or 6%. And we really probably need to go back and look at what our policy is related to fund balance, which is one of our policies on the board side, which is, I think, policy 625. So,
Mr. Roro, if you go back 1 second, just to highlight for the board, keep in mind, if you look at this chart, 08, 09, our overall budget was probably in the 70s, 80 million probably. So as a percentage, it's really significant now.
You bet.
It's a great point, Mr. Hartman.
And I think just philosophy for the board, and that's will be part of the discussion coming up, and where we stand when it comes to fund balance, and when do you utilize fund balance? You know, one camp is fund balance is for that, it's the rainy day fund. It's your kind of personal saving account if your water heater goes out or something to that effect. You know, is it for worst case scenarios? And the question is this a worst case scenario or not that we're experiencing? But again, once you deplete those funds are gone. You have to make it back up the following year with balancing the next year's budget. So it's we've got to be very cautious and strategic in how we're utilizing those funds. Any other comments with fund balance? Okay. Let's go then into taxation. Just an area that we want to consider. We want to make sure you're aware of the strategy and what it could potentially provide for the district. The slide that Kurt's showing is a, you know, we just want to emphasize, I think it's a point of pride for the district in one sense that we have required limited tax increases over the past 10-year period of time. The chart provides a glimpse. What you're seeing is taxation millage rates for the county over the past 10 years. So the right side shows the graphic of the number of times each district raise taxes, and you're going to see
What's highlighted is that Dallas Town only raised taxes 2 times in that time period. So we are the second lowest in the county over that 10-year time period for raising taxes. Although still high, I think what's we should celebrate the work we've done to maintain costs over this time period, has been substantial. And I think it was been very deliberate work to try to save our taxpayers from that burden. But again, this is an area we're going to have to focus and get our head around with further discussion to determine what the threshold is for our board and increasing tax again in a time when economy is not potentially strong, when economy is going to be at one of its lowest points, in my opinion. Before you go on to that, any questions or comments on the data?
Just a thought, and I know this is very premature, but just while this it's applicable with this slide, I'm gonna put my cards on the table. I personally believe that small tax increases every year would be prudent, just even to take care of the cost of inflation. And the only reason why I bring that up now is look at the right-hand column. Look at the school districts, except for West Shore. Look at the school districts that have had tax increases 10 out of 10 years. And millage-wise, we're pretty much so in the same ballpark. And so does a small increase warrant a prudent approach as opposed to a larger increase to take care of a deficit that may have been built or needs that have just been building up like water behind a dam? I'm not asking a question. I'm simply, while this chart is up, saying we're in the same boat that the districts that have raised taxes 10 out of 10 years, we're in the same general area that they are millage-wise.
Yeah.
Just a thought for future consideration. It was applicable with this slide.
Any other comments? Thank you for sharing that, Mr. Wingard. I think it does go back to what is the strategy we want to deploy. And I think we're going to be looking, and we have up to this point, looking year to year, but is there a longer term financial strategy? We had this similar discussions when we're talking capital projects as well. So what is our approach, I think, is going to be critical for us to fine tune, not just this year, but for the years to come. The next slide then just represents, just to give perspective of what, what if we raise taxes each year. So if you go back, and I'm not supportive, I'm not, throwing darts at the history, but I think it's a question just to give you some type of sense, is if we raise taxes over that 10-year period, we're really looking at an additional $54 million in revenue. I've been on record saying I don't want to raise taxes year over year. I was your assistant super for many of those, but it is a worthy conversation as we move forward. Because the deficit this year, just to reemphasize, is not a one-year problem. It's an issue that's been building year over year. And Mr. Wingard's point, we just have to consider moving forward. What are the needs? How are we going to best fund those pieces? So again, just for transparency of what that but for next year, if we go to the next slide, I think is probably what's more critical to the conversation, that provides a dollar figure we could game if we wish to raise taxes in the upcoming year. The Act 1 index allows us to raise taxes 3.3% of the current millage rate of 23.66. So that gives us, if we would raise up to the hilt, that would give us about a $2.2 million revenue stream for the upcoming year. And I guess, Kurt, I want to ask you for that Act 1 index, because we've had conversation. Could you share a little light on, what a bad economy, is the Act, what will that do to our Act 1 index moving forward?
So here's where the Act 1 will go. Obviously, with the state of the economy where it is, you're going to see this number drop dramatically probably next year down in the 1.5, 1.4 range. Back to when we had, the recession of 8-9, 07, 08, that's where the millage or the Act 1 index was at. So I think we need to be prepared for that, even though we may be able to get 3.3% this year, next year we may only be able to get 1.5, and we may need to look at potentially applying for exceptions or something along those lines if we do not continue to fund this in this manner. So I think that's where, you know, based on the situation that we're in, originally when we built this presentation, we didn't know all these factors, but I think that's something you got to keep in mind for the future, is that this Act 1 index will look dramatically different next year, as I foresee it dropping into the middle 1% somewhere. So.
Okay. And then I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but just obviously some variables that we have to consider going into our discussion coming up. You see some of the big ones: economy, state funding, enrollment, as well as negotiations. We'll start with the economy. You know, the question is, what is the impact the corona outbreak will have? And in my opinion, it's going to have a crippling effect on the overall economy and negatively impact our district's financial fortitude. So part of the discussion, regardless of how we fund the $2 million deficit, has to speak to our views on upcoming revenue and expenditure. And I think that's the big unknown. In regard to the assumption with state funding, I think we've already had that discussion, and I'm comfortable based on what feedback we received from the board. I think we'll continue to hold that as true. And then we get into enrollment. Obviously, we're in a unique position here in New York County, being one of the fastest growing districts. So we just, and we have tried to keep you apprised of what's going on from an enrollment standpoint. And just as a friendly reminder that we do have, you know, based on our long-term enrollment predictions, we're still in the next 4.5 to 5 years expecting to increase enrollment over the course of time. So our unique challenge compared to other districts will be, you know, continuing to grow in a time that when the economy is not strong. So it just creates some added pressure and burden. Just in the next slide, we've already touched base on special education. We continue to see obviously an increase over that 10-year period of time with our number of students with IEPs. And again, it just amplifies the disparity that we're not fairly funded by the state or federal government, in my opinion, for students with exceptionality, and they deserve every right to a wonderful education we have to provide and we have to fund. Did touch base again on the cyber, just for information, we provided you some insight on the private versus the DASD cyber. Although we continue to bring in more of these external cyber students, we do have little control over perceived, what I view as a voucher system, where there's choice. Just to amplify, for a private cyber student, regular education, we're paying about $11,000 per year. If you get into special education, you're well over $25,000 per year for some of these external cyber students that we're on the hook for paying. And last but not least is just then, I think it speaks to the York County School of Technology enrollment. You can see that large spike from 18 to 19, and that's a good problem to have because it does say that our pathway model is working. And as I spoke about earlier, it's finding that balance between our educational philosophy of inspiring and creating pathways for these students versus our financial philosophy. And we're going to have to find what that new balance entails. The other big area, and obviously the unknown, as you're aware, the end of this school year marks the conclusion of our current collective bargaining agreement. So even though we're in the midst of negotiating, we have to consider the impact this will have, and we'll need to make some assumptions as a group and administratively coming to you with some of that recommendation, but it is still to be determined that that's an unknown factor. And then finally, I think what I'd like to do is Mr. Blevins and I'd like to engage in more. We threw a lot of information out to you today. We'd like to have some broader conversation on your feedback and more importantly, your threshold on how best to balance the budget. I can easily come to you with a recommendation. However, my concern is if I come to you with a recommendation that's dead upon arrival, and it's a non-starter, I'm not interested in wasting your time or our time So I think, you know, getting some clarity on some of the major things that, Kurt, if you move to the next slide, getting some clarity on some things such as expenditure deferment, in essence, kicking the can down the road to delay some purchases, to delay, to bring in staff as an example, looking at fund balance utilization, tax increase, program cuts, the like, I think will help us solidify where the board stands so that we can come back to you. At the earliest will be during the upcoming finance meeting here in April. So but moving forward with what the prepared budget. So Mr. Blevin, do you have any comments or want to lead the any discussion?
No, I other than, you know, I think that what we're really talking about here is, where are we going to inflict the pain? There's going to be pain no matter what, whether it be expenditure deferment, fund balance, tax increase. The pain will be with our taxpayers. Program cuts, staff cuts, and so we just got to recognize that there is no way to balance this budget without the infliction of pain. I would also point out that in times like this, sometimes there has to be some painful but dramatic overhaul to the expense base of an organization. And I can think back to the Great Recession when I was in the private sector and in an industry that was really hit very, very hard by that. And you know, the only way for us to survive as a company was to dramatically attack our expense base. So was that painful? Yes, it was horrible, but it allowed the organization to survive and move forward and ultimately prosper. And so a resetting of the, when you look at the long-term history of any organization, school district included, I think any organization periodically has to reset their expense base. And so while I'm not taking a position at this point on the tax increase, I want to hear what the rest of you have to say. I would point out again and repeat again that this is going to be painful. You think back to the end of the Weinberg era. It may have been his last or next to last budget, where in an effort to balance that budget, there were dramatic expense reductions, and everybody felt the pain. There were furloughing of teachers. There was a restructuring of the administrative staff. There was some dramatic changes to the way we compensate and utilize support staff. There were changes across the board and a reduction in the administrative staff. There was a huge infliction of pain. But I would argue that a significant part of the reason that we've only had tax increases 2 out of the 10 years is because we had that reset of our expense base. So I want to hear what others have to say, but I just wanted to add a little perspective before you folks chime in.
I just want to ask a couple of clarifying questions before I give my opinion. With the special ed cost, with the baking in that $300,000, do we know? I know with the autistic classroom those two that we took back. I remember having that conversation. You guys were going by the numbers of what the preschool, what the incoming kindergarten class is going to be like. Do we have any idea where those preschool placements are going to be for other special ed, or haven't those taken place yet because of everything that's happened?
I have not seen them. I think we're just kind of basing it off of what we know from previous years. I'm guessing Amy and Brett are working through those right now, but they've obviously probably been challenged because of the fact of not being able to get out and see some of these kiddos to see, you know, where do they truly belong, what type of setting, you know, what type.
Yeah, Brett's here. How about, let's defer that to Brett. Brett, are you comfortable speaking on that behalf?
Yeah, at this point, I know that we're working through some of that. We do have the majority of our placements filled at this point, and talking with Amy this morning, we are filled to capacity with all but one seat at York Township for the incoming school year. With our other placements, I know that we're looking at deploying like our intensive learning support class as well as life skills class. We've seen an increase in those placements. But at this time, I mean, we're getting very, without having those numbers in front of me, I do know that we've seen an increase on those numbers. We did just get numbers from the LIU for verification for preschool numbers. We asked them to verify that information because we have no way of knowing. We don't know those students until they actually enroll into the district. So we did ask to have some of that verified there. And we can see some other trends as far as like within autistic support for the next couple of years coming. So much like what we've seen in the past. But until we get like a direct observation at a preschool, we're really basing our response based upon what the AAU provides us through their preschool program.
Thank you.
And do you think we'll have any more better handle on it before we have to pass this budget?
I feel like, you know, Kurt and Miranda, Dr. Heffler, we've been really kind of, and Amy, have really been trying to kind of drill down on the data to give them as much information as possible for that budget planning. And I know one of the big things is kind of trying to utilize those projections because we're looking at it well in a year in advance as far as making those projections for our special ed budget. But I do feel as though as long as we're continuing that communication and seeing what is coming into the district. And then with Kurt's projection of 300,000, if we look at what we had coming into the district just in LIU placements, that's pretty close to the 300,000 that Kurt has baked into the budget. So I think he's using the historical data to make those decisions, and we're really trying to give him the information that him and Miranda needs to build their budget moving forward. There's always going to be the exceptions to the rule and the move-ins, which, you know, we do the best that we can to communicate that, but I feel like as much as possible, we're filling our programs to capacity and to meet those, you know, budgetary needs as much as possible.
Thank you. And then too, just a clarification, when you were talking about the total for the tier one and the tier two savings, you know, the total would only be like 220 some thousand fund balance usage. Does that include that figure, does that include the replacement of the retirees and no new positions, or what does that include for staff?
Yeah, that includes the no new positions outside of the Loganville Springfield custodian and replacement of the retirees.
Okay, thank you.
So let's have some board members weigh in here relative to, I think fund balance probably is, we might be able to do a little there, but clearly we're bordering on dangerously low levels of fund balance. So I don't think any significant fund should that should be the source of any significant funds. But relative to tax increases, program cuts, staff cuts, replacement of retirees, in those areas, I'd like to hear what other board members have to say at this point.
Excuse me, Mr. Blevins, quick housekeeping question for you. Are we gonna, since this is our first view of the proposed budget book and we all know what it's going to be like, and I have a few detailed questions, but I'm not sure, it seems to me at this point we should keep this pretty high level.
Agreed.
What mechanism then, just follow up with some of these more detailed questions in through, some of through, the detail?
Through Mr. Hartman, if you will.
I would say, and there's been some other board members that have reached out as well. So I'd ask any board members that have some detailed questions, if you want to fire those to me, and I'll get them consolidated. And I think at the next finance meeting, you know, of course, we'll get them over to Kurt. Next finance meeting, maybe we can go over some of those in detail for those that are interested. Because like I said, I had some other board members reach out, and that's probably what we've done in the past, and it's probably the most efficient way to handle those.
Okay, that's great. I know we're running short on time, and I didn't want to get this down and too far into the weeds. Thank you.
I was going to bring that up anyway, so thanks for raising the question. I'll jump in, and to Mr. Blevins' overall point on this budget, there's going to be pain here no matter what we do. I think at this point, I agree our fund balance is dangerously low. So I'd be reluctant to plan to utilize that, knowing that that's been our relief valve if we have to, but the plan to use it is probably not a good idea at this point. The tax increase was going to be tough before, but in light of the economy, it's even tougher for me at this point. That's not necessarily a no, but that's going to be awfully tough. Final thought on this is, you know, our world has changed here in the last month or so. However, we've been on this trajectory for a little while now, and nibbling at the outsides of things. I mean, our overall driver has been, continues to be, and necessarily so, we're a school for crying out loud. So our cost base is going to be teachers and staff. We don't manufacture things. So obviously our staff salary is going to be the big line item, no matter what we do. But however, like say I, even if we were to raise taxes at the maximum, and to Mr. Rohrbaugh's point, I hadn't considered before this morning, but I believe he's correct, the index is going to be lower in subsequent years because of how the formula is. So even if we were to chase taxes, we're still at some point going to have to go after the overall salary. So those are my initial thoughts on things.
Yes, if you don't mind. Got a little sense of history. The thing I like about what you've talked about is I think you've shared the balance. I don't think there's going to be any magic pill in any one area. That I think what we need to talk about is just the balance that you're having and the shared responsibility. I think whatever we do, we have to be clear on our communication and managing the expectations. I still think we can't change our budgetary philosophy. I like that Kurt has been showing some conservatism. But I need to go back to the way back machine, because I know we've all been adamant about taxes, and I think that needs to be the last resort. But the one thing we haven't shared was, you know, where we were 8-10 years ago, where we had the pushback with the tax increases. You know, we're looking at a time when the budgets were rapidly expanding. We had huge budgetary growth. We had a lot of debt that was taken on, and then we got saddled with restructuring the debt every year and reissuing the bonds. The tax rates, you know, Kurt, one thing we didn't show the millage rate over time. That we can't look at any of those one graphs in isolation. That if you layer all that in with the fund balance and the tax millage rate over time, we were increasing taxes and fund balance at the same time. And I think that's where people had an issue, where we were building our reserves unnecessarily. And that's what concerns me at this point. I think the one untouchable at this point is fund balance. With all the uncertainty in our approach, that needs to be our ace in the hole. And for even if we're not bond using it for bond issues, we need to protect that. But I think I would be open to whatever levers need to be pushed. There's a lot on tier one that I could live with. There's a lot on staff that I could live with. But conversely, I'm really worried, you know, special ed we've been hearing about, I'm a little leery of just cross cuts on the special ed assistant when that's a department that we know is expanding and we're frying our people out, literally. No pun intended, Brett. But I really just think we need to be reasonable in all of this and make sure that there's enough shared pain across the board.
Thank you, Bill. Any other thoughts?
Yeah, I'll give you a quick thought. I do agree with the fund balance with what everyone's saying. We can't keep relying on that to balance our budget. We saw, we are getting into a point where we got to be careful, and we know going forward for the next year or two, we really don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what the ramifications of these last couple of months are going to be for us going forward. So I do think we need to keep that intact as much as possible. I don't have a problem using it a little of it, but I don't want to use everything, to balance the budget. I agree with Bill. I think this has to be something across the board. I'm not crazy about a tax increase. I think though we have to be realistic about what we're looking at, but I don't think we can just put it back on a tax increase. We do have to look at program cuts, staff cuts. We do have to look at everything and try to see where we can best utilize our resources and have that pain shared from everyone.
Anyone else care to weigh in?
I guess I'll go. The tax increase would be a tough pill to swallow, but it might be our hands are tied no matter what. The fund balance, we get it too much lower. Something really does come up. We don't have anywhere to go to get some money. And like everybody else says, I like the balanced approach that, the pain's going to be the pain, but you divide it out. Hopefully it's not as painful, if that makes any sense.
I guess I'll go. I don't like to repeat things, but I think for the sake of discussion here, I think it's important that we all say what we feel on each particular item, because I think it's going to have to be a lever by lever approach. It's been mentioned about fund balance being dangerously low. I would suggest that it's probably beyond dangerously low. And, we're right around 6% projected. And my real fear is we don't have a long-term plan to replenish that. And it's already to the point where it could affect the long-term additional borrowing, things in the future that we may need as a percentage. And I think dipping into that in any real meaningful way is I think that's going to hurt us long term. The problem I have with the tax increase conversation is the budget book doesn't have page numbers this year, so I don't know what page it is, but it shows there's a chart that shows the impact on a home value, and I get what we're trying to show there. We're trying to show that And a tax increase to the max is only going to be an additional $200 burden on the average household. I think the fallacy of that chart is not $200 additional this year. I think the fallacy of that chart is, I think there are going to be some people who are going to have a real hard time paying any of it. I mean, if you look at unemployment numbers and the way they've spiked a tremendous amount over the last 2 weeks, even more than the last, I think the article I read, more than the last couple of recessions. And so that's going to be a very hard pill for me to swallow. And I think that what Mr. Blevins said, I think he said it the best. I think we need to make a reset. And I think we need to look at everything across the board and figure out where we can make the least amount of impact to the students and the most impact on the dollars to get there. Because, just throwing 3% tax increase at this covers the deficit for this year. And then what about next year? And I know the comment was made, I don't remember who made it, you know, there was a comment made about if we had increased throughout the years, we'd have $54 million. By my quick math, that also puts us at a mill rate over 29, which puts us number two behind New York City. So it's hard to look at this in a vacuum. I think we have to look at everything, but the tax increase and the FUD balance would be the two lowest things on my list. Thanks.
I think for me, I'll just jump in real quick. I reached out to Mr. Hartman last night. I took a little bit of a deep dive into the budget book this weekend. And for me, I just need to have some questions answered, specific questions like Mr. Pantano was referring to, with the budget book first, before I could move on with this decision. But I would be for a tax increase if it would show that it's directly enhancing the quality education that we're providing our students, but just that we're making sure we're cutting everywhere else we can right now, because obviously it's not a great time. Just my opinions right now.
Thank you, Sarah. Any other comments from the board?
Yeah, I'll just say some random thoughts that I wrote down while you were talking. I agree with the fund balance. I've always been comfortable at that 8% level, and dipping below that, which we're dipping our toes into, I'm not that comfortable with. I like that we haven't raised taxes a whole lot in 10 years, just two times. However, you know, there's rumor that this whole virus is going to come back in the fall. It might be seasonal. I hate to hang our hat on a tax increase, not knowing if we're completely killing our economy. What if we have to go back into this time? I wish we could predict the future and see what's coming up, but we can't. There's been a lot of talk about our special ed. I'm not comfortable at this point saying that I definitely think we should cut the assistant director of special ed, because I think if I had to prioritize that list, that would definitely be at the top of my list as something to keep. Don't know if we can, but that and curriculum writing, I hate to, that would probably also be near the top of my list. I wonder if now that we are in this mode of trying to provide online education to our kids, if we're closer to being able to offer K-3 cyber, and that would be, I know, again, I feel like everything's peanuts. We almost all need to link arms and kind of draw in the circle and squeeze the juice out of the lemon, or whatever that saying was that somebody said earlier. I hate to not offer field trips and activities. I don't know if we can squeeze something out of PTOs, booster clubs, even turning to families for a great part. Seeing a families will help pay for busing to some of these field trips and activities, because I hate to just cut all of them without trying to share some of that burden. Anyway, those are my random thoughts. Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay.
I could, Mr. Blevins, real quick, a point of housekeeping with all the changes. When is the next finance meeting? It was scheduled for the 16th, I believe. Mrs. Kirby, do we have one scheduled? Or?
Yes, that it's still the same date.
Yeah, it is the 16th at 7 p.m.
Okay, what I'm thinking again, like I say, a few board members have reached out. If you do have specific budget questions, I would propose let's try to have those to me by, say, the 9th or 10th. That gives me a chance to consolidate and get with Mr. Warball so he can answer them on the finance meeting. That sounds fair to everyone.
I would just like to make one or two more points, if I could. When we're talking about tax rates and millage rates and comparisons to other districts, we have to keep in mind that our industrial and commercial base compared to many other districts is much lower. So a much higher percentage of our tax burden is paid by homeowners and families as opposed to businesses. And so that adds even more pain at the personal level to a tax increase. And I also feel that you know, a blended approach to this is appropriate. And I think, you know, through your very fine presentation today, you've identified some areas where maybe some of the assumptions are a little too conservative that possibly could be to help here. But also, again, I would encourage the administrators, the principals, and the leadership team and all the mid-level administrators to try to be creative in your thinking when it comes to retiree replacements, when it comes to cuts. None of us want to hurt the educational quality of the kids. There's not one member of the school board that's in favor of that. But if you're creative through the redeployment, reallocation of expenses and resources, if you're creative, you might surprise yourself what kind of budgetary impact you could have in doing that. So I would strongly encourage you to not just assume that some of those things on the list are not doable. I would ask you to be creative and step out of the box and try to figure out a way to attack the expense base of the district. It's in everyone's long-term best interest, including that of the kids, if you do that. So that's my comment. So anything else, Dr. Dahl, on this discussion?
No, just I appreciate your conversation. Obviously, I think what we're going to have to get to, and I got some sentiment, what the threshold is. The emphasis is kind of connected to the presentation, is finding the balance and finding the right balance. We will, I think, be prepared, and we'll have some additional discussion with some other levers when we go into an exec session, but we will be prepared to try to develop what we view as a balanced approach. I recognize, though, we have, you know, 9 members of our board with 9, if you kind of tease out what each of you said, have a little different varied threshold and viewpoint on that. So I think the best piece right now will be to share, you know, answer your questions first and foremost, put forth what a recommendation, at least then we can have some reaction with that. But at the end of the day, we're still on a pretty aggressive timeline between now and June to get some type of finality on where we are with the budget. So I do appreciate it. This is, to Mr. Blevins, how he started, it's painful. I think it's painful no matter what we look at. We will certainly roll up our sleeves and try to, you know, develop some type of budget that meets a balanced approach. And your feedback today was helpful in doing so.
Okay. Well, thank you all for your excellent preparation for this presentation. You did a fine job. You gave us very useful data. The calendar of board events is there on the agenda for your review. And now we'll go to the second and final opportunity for any public comment. Hearing none, we'll adjourn to executive session, and let's give ourselves a little break here. And maybe it's 11:40, maybe 15 minutes from now. Does that work?
Very good.
Okay. Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you all.